Mrs. Coulter smiled at Lyra in a way that seemed to say, "You and I understand these things, don't we?" and moved on to greet some other guests. Pantalaimon was whispering in Lyra's ear.
"While she was here, her demon was coming out of our bedroom. He's been spying. He knows about the alethiometer."
Lyra felt that that was probably true, but there was nothing she could do about it. What had that professor been saying about the gobblers? She looked around to find him again, but no sooner had she seen him than the commissionaire, in servant's dress for the evening, and another man tapped the professor on the shoulder and spoke quietly to him, at which he turned pale and followed them out. That took no more than a couple of seconds, and it was so discreetly done that hardly anyone noticed. But it left Lyra feeling anxious and exposed. She wandered through the two big rooms where the party was taking place, half listening to the conversations around her, half interested in the taste of the cocktails she wasn't allowed to try, and increasingly fretful. She wasn't aware that anyone was watching her until the commissionaire appeared at her side and bent to say,
"Miss Lyra, the gentleman by the fireplace would like to speak to you. He's Lord Boreal, if you didn't know."
Lyra looked up across the room. The powerful-looking grey-haired man was looking directly at her, and as their eyes met, he nodded and beckoned. Unwilling, but more interested now, she went across.
"Good evening, child,"
said Lord Boreal. His voice was smooth and commanding. His serpent demon's mailed head and emerald eyes glittered in the light from the cut glass lamp on the wall nearby.
"Good evening.
How is my old friend, the Master of Jordan?"
"Very well, thank you."
"I expect they were all sorry to say goodbye to you."
"Yes, they were."
"And is Mrs. Coulter keeping you busy? What is she teaching you?"
Because Lyra was feeling rebellious and uneasy, she didn't answer this patronizing question with the truth, or with one of her usual flights of fancy. Instead, she said,
"I'm learning about Rusakov particles and about the ablation board."
He seemed to become focused at once, in the same way that you could focus the beam of an Anbaric lantern. All his attention streamed at her fiercely.
"Suppose you tell me what you know."
"They're doing experiments in the north,"
Lyra said. She was feeling reckless now.
"Like Dr. Grumman."
"Go on."
"They've got this special kind of photogram where you can see dust. And when you see a man, there's like all light coming to him. And there's none on a child. At least, not so much."
"Did Mrs. Coulter show you a picture like that?"
Lyra hesitated, for this was not lying, but something else, and she wasn't practiced at it.
"No,"
she said after a moment.
"I saw that one at Jordan College."
"Who showed it to you?"
"He wasn't really showing it to me. I was just passing and I saw it. And then my friend Roger was taken by the ablation board. But..."
"Who showed you that picture?"
"My Uncle Azrael."
"When?"
"When he was in Jordan College last time."
"I see. And what else have you been learning about? Did I hear you mention the ablation board?"
"Yes, but I didn't hear about that from him. I heard it here."
Which was exactly true, she thought. He was looking at her narrowly. She gazed back with all the innocence she had. Finally, he nodded.
"Then Mrs. Coulter must have decided you were ready to help her in that work. Interesting. Have you taken part yet?"
"No,"
said Lyra. What was he talking about? Pantalaimon was cleverly in his most inexpressive shape, a moth, and couldn't betray her feelings, and she was sure she could keep her own face innocent.
"And has she told you what happens to the children?"
"No, she hasn't told me that. I only just know that it's about dust, and they're like a kind of sacrifice."
Again, that wasn't exactly a lie, she thought. She had never said that Mrs. Coulter herself had told her.
"Sacrifice is rather a dramatic way of putting it. What's done is for their good as well as ours. And, of course, they all come to Mrs. Coulter willingly. That's why she's so valuable. They must want to take part. And what child could resist her? And if she's going to use you as well to bring them in, so much the better. I'm very pleased."
He smiled at her in the way Mrs. Coulter had, as if they were both in on a secret. She smiled politely back, and he turned away to talk to someone else. She and Pantalaimon could sense each other's horror. She wanted to go away by herself and talk to him. She wanted to leave the flat. She wanted to go back to Jordan College and her little shabby bedroom on Staircase 12. She wanted to find Lord Azrael. And as if in answer to that last wish, she heard his name mentioned and wandered closer to the group talking nearby with the pretext of helping herself to a canapé from the plate on the table. A man in a bishop's purple was saying,
"No, I don't think Lord Azrael will be troubling us for quite some time."
"And where did you say he was being held?"
In the fortress of Svalbard, I'm told, guarded by Panserbjörner. You know, armored bears? Formidable creatures. He won't escape from them if he lives to be 1,000. The fact is, I really think the way is clear. Very nearly clear.
The last experiments have confirmed what I always believed. The dust is an emanation from the dark principle itself, and...
Do I detect the Zoroastrian heresy?
Well, it used to be a heresy.
And if we could isolate the dark principle...
Svalbard, did you say?
Armored bears.
The oblation board.
The children don't suffer, I'm sure of it.
Lord Asriel imprisoned.
Lyra had heard enough. She turned away, and moving as quietly as the moth Pantalaimon, she went into her bedroom and closed the door. The noise of the party was muffled at once.
Well?
She whispered, and he became a goldfinch on her shoulder.
Are we going to run away?
Of course. If we do it now with all these people about, she might not notice for a while.
He will.
Pantalaimon meant Mrs. Coulter's demon. When Lyra thought of his lithe golden shape, she felt ill with fear.
I'll fight him this time. I can change, and he can't. I'll change so quickly he won't be able to keep hold. This time, I'll win. You'll see.
Lyra nodded distractedly. What should she wear? How could she get out without being seen?
You'll have to go and spy. As soon as it's clear, we'll have to run. Be a moth. Remember, the second there's no one looking.
She opened the door a crack and he crawled out, dark against the warm pink light in the corridor. Meanwhile, she hastily flung on the warmest clothes she had and stuffed some more into one of the coal silk bags from the fashionable shop they'd visited that very afternoon. Mrs. Coulter had given her money like sweets, and although she had spent it lavishly, there were still several sovereigns left, which she put in the pocket of the dark wolf-skin coat before tiptoeing to the door. Last of all, she packed the alethiometer in its black velvet cloth. Had that abominable monkey found it? He must have done. He must have told her. Oh, if she'd only hidden it better! She tiptoed to the door. Her room opened into the end of the corridor nearest the hall, luckily, and most of the guests were in the two big rooms further along. There was the sound of voices talking loudly, laughter, the quiet flushing of a lavatory, the tinkle of glasses. And then a tiny moth voice at her ear said,
"Now, quick!"
She slipped through the door and into the hall, and in less than 3 seconds she was opening the front door of the flat. A moment after that she was through and pulling it quietly shut, and with Pantalaimon a goldfinch again, she ran for the stairs and fled. Chapter 6. The Throwing Nets. She walked quickly away from the river because the embankment was wide and well lit. There was a tangle of narrow streets between there and the Royal Arctic Institute, which was the only place Lyra was sure of being able to find, and into that dark maze she hurried now. If only she knew London as well as she knew Oxford. Then she would have known which streets to avoid, or where she could scrounge some food, or best of all, which doors to knock on and find shelter. In that cold night, the dark alleys all around were alive with movement and secret life, and she knew none of it. Pantalaimon became a wildcat and scanned the dark all around with his night-piercing eyes. Every so often he'd stop, bristling, and she would turn aside from the entrance she'd been about to go down. The night was full of noises, bursts of drunken laughter, two raucous voices raised in song, the clatter and whine of some badly oiled machine in a basement. Lyra walked delicately through it all, her senses magnified and mingled with Pantalaimon's, keeping to the shadows and the narrow alleys. From time to time she had to cross a wider, well-lit street, where the tram cars hummed and sparked under their amberic wires. There were rules for crossing London streets, but she took no notice, and when anyone shouted, she fled. It was a fine thing to be free again. She knew that Pantalaimon, padding on wildcat paws beside her, felt the same joy as she did to be in the open air, even if it was murky London air laden with fumes and soot and clangorous with noise. Sometime soon they'd have to think over the meaning of what they'd heard in Mrs. Coulter's flat, but not yet. And sometime eventually they'd have to find a place to sleep. At a crossroads near the corner of a big department store, whose windows shone brilliantly over the wet pavement, there was a coffee stall. A little hut on wheels with a counter under the wooden flap that swung up like an awning. Yellow light glowed inside, and the fragrance of coffee drifted out. The white-coated owner was leaning on the counter talking to the two or three customers. It was tempting. Lyra had been walking for an hour now, and it was cold and damp. With Pantalaimon a sparrow, she went up to the counter and reached up to gain the owner's attention.
"Cup of coffee and a ham sandwich, please."
"You're out late, my dear,"
said a gentleman in a top hat and white silk muffler.
"Yeah,"
she said, turning away from him to scan the busy intersection. A theatre nearby was just emptying, and crowds milled around the lighted foyer, calling for cabs, wrapping coats around their shoulders. In the other direction was the entrance of a Clonic railway station, with more crowds pouring up and down the steps.
Here you are, love,
said the coffee stall man.
2 shillings.
Let me pay for this,
said the man in the top hat. Lyra thought, why not? I can run faster than him, and I might need all my money later. The top-hatted man dropped a coin on the counter and smiled down at her. His demon was a lemur. It clung to his lapel, staring round-eyed at Lyra. She bit into her sandwich and kept her eyes on the busy street. She had no idea where she was, because she had never seen a map of London, and she didn't even know how big it was or how far she'd have to walk to find the country.
What's your name?
Alice.
Oh, that's a pretty name. Let me put a drop of this into your coffee. Warm you up.
He was unscrewing the top of a silver flask.
I don't like that. I just like coffee.
I bet you've never had brandy like this before.
I have. I was sick all over the place. I had a whole bottle, or nearly.
Just as you like,
said the man, tilting the flask into his own cup.
Where are you going, all alone like this?
Going to meet my father.
And who's here?
He's a murderer.
His what?
I told you, he's a murderer. It's his profession. He's doing a job tonight. I got his clean clothes in here because he's usually all covered in blood when he's finished a job.
Ah, you're joking.
I ain't.
The lemur uttered a soft mewing sound and clambered slowly up behind the man's head to peer out at her. She drank her coffee stolidly and ate the last of her sandwich.
Good night. I can see my father coming now. He looks a bit angry.
The top hat man glanced around, and Lyra set off toward the theatre crowd. Much as she would have liked to see the Clonic Railway, Mrs. Coulter had said it was not really intended for people of their class, she was wary of being trapped underground. Better to be out in the open where she could run if she had to. On and on she walked, and the streets became darker and emptier. It was drizzling, but even if there'd been no clouds, the city sky was too tainted with light to show the stars. Pantalaimon thought they were going north, but who could tell? Endless streets of little identical brick houses, with gardens only big enough for a dustbin. Great gaunt factories behind wire fences, with one anbaric light glowing bleakly high up on a wall, and a night watchman snoozing by his brazier. Occasionally a dismal oratory, only distinguished from a warehouse by the crucifix outside. Once she tried the door of one of these places, only to hear a groan from the bench a foot away in the darkness. She realized that the porch was full of sleeping figures, and fled.
Where are we going to sleep, Pan?
She said as they trudged down a street of closed and shuttered shops.
A doorway somewhere.
Don't want to be seen, though. They're all so open.
There's a canal down there.
He was looking down a side road to the left. Sure enough, a patch of dark glimmer showed open water, and when they cautiously went to look, they found a canal basin where a dozen or so barges were tied up at the wharves, some high in the water, some low and laden under the gallows-like cranes. A dim light shone in one window of a wooden hut, and a thread of smoke rose from the metal chimney. Otherwise, the only lights were high up on the wall of the warehouse or the gantry of a crane, leaving the ground in gloom. The wharves were piled with barrels of coal spirit, with stacks of great round logs, with rolls of caoutchouc-covered cable. Lyra tiptoed up to the hut and peeped in at the window. An old man was laboriously reading a picture story paper and smoking a pipe, with his spaniel demon curled up asleep on the table. As she looked, the man got up and brought a blackened kettle from the iron stove and poured some hot water into a cracked mug before settling back with his paper.
Should we ask him to let us in, Pan?
She whispered, but he was distracted. He was a bat, an owl, a wildcat again. She looked all round, catching his panic, and then saw them at the same time as he did, 2 men running at her, one from each side, the nearer holding a throwing net. Pantalaimon uttered a harsh scream and launched himself as a leopard at the closer man's demon, a savage-looking fox, bowling her backward and tangling with the man's legs. The man cursed and dodged aside, and Lyra darted past him towards the open spaces of the wharf. What she mustn't do was get boxed in a corner. Pantalaimon, an eagle now, swooped at her and cried,
Left! Left!
She swerved that way and saw a gap between the coal spirit barrels and the end of a corrugated iron shed and darted for it like a bullet. But those throwing nets! She heard a hiss in the air and past her cheek something lashed and sharply stung, and loathsome tarred strings whipped across her face, her arms, her hands, and tangled and held her, and she fell, snarling and tearing and struggling in vain.
Pan! Pan! Pan!
But the fox demon tore at the cat Pantalaimon, and Lyra felt the pain in her own flesh and sobbed a great cry as he fell. One man was swiftly lashing cords around her limbs, her throat, body, head, bundling her over and over on the wet ground. She was helpless, exactly like a fly being trussed by a spider. Poor hurt Pan was dragging himself toward her, with a fox demon worrying his back, and he had no strength left to change even, and the other man was lying in a puddle with an arrow through his neck. The whole world grew still as the man tying the net saw it too. Pantalaimon sat up and blinked, and then there was a soft thud, and the net man fell, choking and gasping right across Lyra, who cried out in horror. That was blood gushing out of him. Running feet, and someone hauled the man away and bent over him. Then other hands lifted Lyra. A knife snicked and pulled, and the net strings fell away one by one, and she tore them off, spitting, and hurled herself down to cuddle Pantalaimon. Kneeling, she twisted to look up at the newcomers. Three dark men, one armed with a bow, the others with knives. And as she turned, the bowman caught his breath.
That ain't Lyra.
A familiar voice, but she couldn't place it till he stepped forward and the nearest light fell on his face and the hawk demon on his shoulder. Then she had it. Egyptian. A real Oxford Egyptian.
Tony Caster,
he said.
Remember? You used to play with my little brother Billy off the boats in Jericho before the gobblers got him.
Oh, God, Pan. We're safe.
She sobbed, but then a thought rushed into her mind. It was the Caster's boat she'd hijacked that day. Suppose he remembered.
Better come along with us. You alone?
Yeah. I was running away.
All right. Don't talk now. Just keep quiet. Jack, sir, move them bodies into the shadow. Kareem, look around.
Lyra stood up shakily, holding the wildcat Pantalaimon to her breast. He was twisting to look at something, and she followed his gaze, understanding and suddenly curious, too. What had happened to the dead men's demons? They were fading, that was the answer. Fading and drifting away like atoms of smoke, for all that they tried to cling to their men. Pantalaimon hid his eyes, and Lyra hurried blindly after Tony Costa.
What are you doing here?
Quiet, gal. There's enough trouble to wait without stirring more. We'll talk on the boat.
He led her over a little wooden bridge into the heart of the canal basin. The other two men were padding silently after them. Tony turned along the waterfront and out onto a wooden jetty, from which he stepped on board a narrowboat and swung open the door to the cabin.
Get in. Quick now.
Lyra did so, patting her bag, which she had never let go of, even in the net, to make sure the alethiometer was still there. In the long, narrow cabin, by the light of a lantern on a hook, she saw a stout, powerful woman with grey hair sitting at a table with a paper. Lyra recognised her as Billy's mother.
Who's this? That's never Lyra.
That's right. Ma, we gotta move. We killed two men out in the basin. We thought they was gobblers, but I reckon they were Turk traders. They caught Lyra. Never mind talk. We'll do that on the move.
Come here, child,
said Ma Costa. Lyra obeyed, half happy, half apprehensive, for Ma Costa had hands like bludgeons, and now she was sure it was their boat she had captured with Roger and the other colleges. But the boat mother set her hands on either side of Lyra's face, and her demon, a hawk, bent gently to lick Pantalaimon's wildcat head. Then Ma Costa folded her great arms around Lyra and pressed her to her breast.
I don't know what you're doing here, but you look wore out. You can have Billy's crib, soon as I got a hot drink in you. Set you down there, child.
It looked as if her piracy was forgiven, or at least forgotten. Lyra slid onto the cushioned bench behind a well-scrubbed pine tabletop as the low rumble of the gas engine shook the boat.
Where are we going?
Mark Costa was setting a saucepan of milk on the iron stove and riddling the grate to stir the fire up.
Away from here. No talking now. We'll talk in the morning.
And she said no more, handing Lyra a cup of milk when it was ready, swinging herself up on deck when the boat began to move, exchanging occasional whispers with the men. Lyra sipped the milk and lifted a corner of the blind to watch the dark wharves move past. A minute or two later, she was sound asleep. She awoke in a narrow bed, with that comforting engine rumble deep below. She sat up, banged her head, cursed, felt around, and got up more carefully. A thin grey light showed her three other bunks, each empty and neatly made, one below hers and the other two across the tiny cabin. She swung over the side to find herself in her underclothes, and saw the dress and the wolfskin coat folded at the end of her bunk together with her shopping bag. The alethiometer was still there. She dressed quickly and went through the door at the end to find herself in the cabin with the stove, where it was warm. There was no one there. Through the windows she saw a grey swirl of fog on each side, with occasional dark shapes that might have been buildings or trees. Before she could go out on deck, the outer door opened and Mark Costa came down, swathed in an old tweed coat on which the damp had settled like a thousand tiny pearls.
"Sleep well?"
she said, reaching for a frying pan.
"Now sit down out the way and I'll make you some breakfast. Don't stand about, there ain't room."
"Where are we?"
"On the Grand Junction Canal. Now, you keep out of sight, child. I don't want to see you topside. There's trouble."
She sliced a couple of rashers of bacon into the frying pan and cracked an egg to go with them.
"What sort of trouble?"
"Nothing we can't cope with if you stay out the way."
And she wouldn't say any more till Lara had eaten. The boat slowed at one point and something banged against the side and she heard men's voices raised in anger. But then someone's joke made them laugh and the voices drew away and the boat moved on. Presently Tony Costa swung down into the cabin. Like his mother, he was pearled with damp, and he shook his woolen hat over the stove to make the drops jump and spit.
"What are we going to tell her, Ma?"
"Ask first, tell after."
He poured some coffee into a tin cup and sat down. He was a powerful, dark-faced man, and now that she could see him in daylight, Lyra saw a sad grimness in his expression.
"Right. Now, you tell us what you was doing in London, Lyra. We had you down as being took by the gobblers."
"I was living with this lady, right?"
Lyra clumsily collected her story and shook it into order as if she were settling a pack of cards ready for dealing. She told them everything, except about the alethiometer.
"And then last night at this cocktail party, I found out what they were really doing. Mrs. Coulter was one of the gobblers herself, and she was going to use me to help her catch more kids. And what they do is..."
Mark Oster left the cabin and went out to the cockpit. Tony waited till the door was shut and cut in.
"We know what they do. At least we know part of it. We know they don't come back. Them kids is taken up north, far out the way. And they do experiments on them. At first, we reckon they tried out different diseases and medicines, but there'd be no reason to start that all of a sudden 2 or 3 years back. Then we thought about the Tartars. Maybe there's some secret deal they're making up Siberia way, because the Tartars want to move north just as much as the rest, for the coal, spirit and the fire mines. And there's been rumours of war for even longer than the gobblers been going. And we reckon the gobblers were buying off the Tartar chiefs by giving them kids, because the Tartars eat them, don't they? They bake children and eat them."
"They never..."
"They do. There's plenty of other things to be told and all. You ever heard of the Nelkynans?"
"No, not even with Mrs. Coulter. What are they?"
"Ah, that's the kind of ghost they have up there in those forests. Same size as child, and they got no heads. They feel their way about at night, and if you're sleeping out in the forest, they get a hold of you and won't nothing make them let go. Nelkynans, that's a northern word. And the windsuckers, they're dangerous too. They drift about in the air. You come across clumps of them floated together sometimes, or caught, snagged on a bramble. As soon as they touch you, all the strength goes out of you. You can't see them except as a kind of shimmer in the air. And the breathless ones..."
"Who are they?"
"Warriors, half killed. Being alive is one thing, and being dead's another. But being half killed is worse than either. They just can't die, and living is altogether beyond them. They wander about forever. They're called the breathless ones because of what's been done to them."
"And what's that?"
"Ah, the North Tartars snap open their ribs and pull out their lungs. There's an art to it. They do it without killing them, but their lungs can't work anymore without their demons pumping them by hand. So the result is they're halfway between breath and no breath, life and death. Half killed, you see. And their demons got to pump and pump all day and night, or else perish with them. You come across a whole platoon of breathless ones in the forest sometimes, I've heard. And then there's the Panserbjörne. You heard of them? That means armoured bears. They're great white bears and..."
"Ah, yes, I have heard of them. One of the men last night, he said that my uncle, Lord Asriel, he's being imprisoned in a fortress guarded by the armoured bears."
"Is he now? And what was he doing up there?"
"Exploring. But the way the man was talking, I don't think my uncle's on the same side as the gobblers. I think they were glad he was in prison."
"Well, he won't get out if the armoured bears are guarding him. They're like mercenaries. You know what I mean by that? They sell their strength to whoever pays. They got hands like men, and they learn the trick of working iron way back, meteoric iron mostly, and they make great sheets and plates of it to cover themselves with. They've been raiding the Skraelings for centuries. They're vicious killers, absolutely pitiless. But they keep their word. If you make a bargain with a Panserbjörn, you can rely on it."
Lyra considered these horrors with awe.
"Ma don't like to hear about the North,"
Tony said after a few moments.
"Because of what might have happened to Billy. We know they took him up north, see?"
"How do you know that?"
We caught one of the gobblers and made him talk. That's how we know a little about what they're doing. Them two last night weren't gobblers. Ah, they were too clumsy. If they'd been gobblers, we'd have took them alive. See, the Egyptian people, we've been hit worse than most by these gobblers. And we were coming together to decide what to do about it. That's what we was doing in the basin last night. Taking on stores, because we're going to a big muster up in the fens, what we call a roping. And what I reckon is we're going to send out a rescue party when we heard what all the other Egyptians know, when we put our knowledge together. That's what I'd do if I was John Fa.
Who's John Fa?
The king of the Egyptians.
And you're really going to rescue the kids? What about Roger?
Who's Roger?
The Jordan College kitchen boy. He was took same as Billy the day before I come away with Mrs. Coulter. I bet if I was took, he'd come and rescue me. If you're going to rescue Billy, I want to come too and rescue Roger.
And Uncle Azrael, she thought. But she didn't mention that. Chapter 7. John Farr. Now that Lyra had a task in mind, she felt much better. Helping Mrs. Coulter had been all very well, but Pantaliman was right. She wasn't really doing any work there, she was just a pretty pet. On the Egyptian boat there was real work to do, and Ma Costa made sure she did it. She cleaned and swept, she peeled potatoes and made tea, she greased the propeller shaft bearings, she kept the weed trap clear over the propeller, she washed dishes, she opened lock gates, she tied the boat up at mooring posts, and within a couple of days she was as much at home with this new life as if she'd been born Egyptian. What she didn't notice was that the Costas were alert every second for unusual signs of interest in Lyra from the waterside people. If she hadn't realized it, she was important, and Mrs. Coulter and the Oblation Board were bound to be searching everywhere for her. Indeed, Tony heard from gossip in pubs along the way that the police were making raids on houses and farms and building yards and factories without any explanation, though there was a rumor that they were searching for a missing girl. And that in itself was odd, considering all the kids that had gone missing without being looked for. Egyptians and land folk alike were getting jumpy and nervous. And there was another reason for the Costas' interest in Lyra, but she wasn't to learn that for a few days yet. So they took to keeping her below decks when they passed a lock keeper's cottage or a canal basin, or anywhere there were likely to be idlers hanging about. Once they passed through a town where the police were searching all the boats that came along the waterway and holding up the traffic in both directions. The Costas were equal to that, though. There was a secret compartment beneath Ma's bunk, where Lyra lay cramped for 2 hours while the police banged up and down the length of the boat, unsuccessfully.
Why didn't their demons find me, though?
She asked afterwards, and Ma showed her the lining of the secret space, cedarwood, which had a soporific effect on demons. And it was true that Pantaliman had spent the whole time happily asleep by Lyra's head. Slowly, with many halts and detours, the Costas' boat drew nearer the fens, that wide and never fully mapped wilderness of huge skies and endless marshland in eastern Anglia. The furthest fringe of it mingled indistinguishably with the creeks and tidal inlets of the shallow sea, and the other side of the sea mingled indistinguishably with Holland, and parts of the fens had been drained and diked by Hollanders, some of whom had settled there, so the language of the fens was thick with Dutch. But parts had never been drained or planted or settled at all, and in the wildest central regions, where eels slithered and waterbirds flocked, where eerie marsh fires flickered and waylurkers tempted careless travellers to their doom in the swamps and bogs, the Egyptian people had always found it safe to muster. And now by a thousand winding channels and creeks and watercourses, Egyptian boats were moving in towards the Bayernplatz, the only patch of slightly higher ground in the hundreds of square miles of marsh and bog. There was an ancient wooden meeting hall there with a huddle of permanent dwellings around it, and wharves and jetties, and an eel market. When the Egyptians called a Bayern roping, a summons or muster of families, so many boats filled the waterways that you could walk for a mile in any direction over their decks, or so it was said. The Egyptians ruled in the fens. No one else dared enter, and while Egyptians kept the peace and traded fairly, the landlopers turned a blind eye to the incessant smuggling and the occasional feuds. If Egyptian body floated ashore down the coast or got snagged in a fishnet, well, it was only Egyptian. Lyra listened enthralled to tales of the fen dwellers, of the great ghost dog Black Shuck, of the marsh fires arising from bubbles of witch oil, and began to think of herself as Egyptian even before they reached the fens. She had soon slipped back into her Oxford voice, and now she was acquiring an Egyptian one, complete with Fen Dutch words. Ma Costa had to remind her of a few things.
You ain't Egyptian, Lyra. You might pass for Egyptian with practice, but there's more to us than Egyptian language. There's deep sinners and strong currents. We're water people all through, and you ain't. You're a fire person. What you're most like is marsh fire. That's the place you have in the Egyptian scheme. You got witch oil in your soul. Deceptive, that's what you are, child.
Lyra was hurt.
I ain't never deceived anyone. You ask.
There was no one to ask, of course, and Marcosta laughed, but kindly.
Can't you see I'm paying you a compliment, you gosling?
She said, and Lyra was pacified, though she didn't understand. When they reached the Bayernplatz, it was evening, and the sun was about to set in a splash of bloody sky. The low island and the Saal were humped blackly against the light, like the clustered buildings around. Threads of smoke rose into the still air, and from the press of boats all around came the smells of frying fish, of smoke leaf, of Geneva spirit. They tied up close to the Saal itself, at a mooring Tony said had been used by their family for generations. Presently Marcosta had the frying pan going with a couple of fat eels hissing and sputtering and the kettle on for potato powder. Tony and Karim oiled their hair, put on their finest leather jackets and blue spotted neckerchiefs, loaded their fingers with silver rings, and went to greet some old friends in the neighbouring boats and drink a glass or two in the nearest bar. They came back with important news.
We got here just in time. The roping's this very night, and they're saying in town, what do you think of this? They're saying that the missing child's on an Egyptian boat, and she's going to appear tonight at the roping.
He laughed loudly and ruffled Lyra's hair. Ever since they'd entered the fens, he had been more and more good-tempered, as if the savage gloom his face showed outside were only a disguise. And Lyra felt an excitement growing in her breast as she ate quickly and washed the dishes before combing her hair, tucking the alethiometer into the wolfskin coat pocket, and jumping ashore with all the other families making their way up the slope to the Saal. She had thought Tony was joking. She soon found that he wasn't, or else that she looked less like Egyptian than she'd thought, for many people stared, and children pointed, and by the time they reached the great doors of the Saal, they were walking alone between a crowd on either side, who had fallen back to stare and give them room. And then Lyra began to feel truly nervous. She kept close to Marcosta, and Pantaliman became as big as he could and took his panther shape to reassure her. Marcosta trudged up the steps as if nothing in the world could possibly either stop her or make her go more quickly, and Tony and Karim walked proudly on either side like princes. The hall was lit by naphtha lamps, which shone brightly enough on the faces and bodies of the audience, but left the lofty rafters hidden in darkness. The people coming in had to struggle to find room on the floor, where the benches were already crowded, but families squeezed up to make space, children occupying laps and demons curling up underfoot or perching out of the way on the rough wooden walls. At the front of the Saal there was a platform with 8 carved wooden chairs set out. As Lyra and the Costas found space to stand along the edge of the hall, 8 men appeared from the shadows at the rear of the platform and stood in front of the chairs. A ripple of excitement swept over the audience as they hushed one another and shoved themselves into spaces on the nearest bench. Finally there was silence, and 7 of the men on the platform sat down. The one who remained was in his 70s, but tall and bull-necked and powerful. He wore a plain canvas jacket and a checked shirt, like many Egyptian men. There was nothing to mark him out but the air of strength and authority he had. Lyra recognized it. Uncle Azrael had it, and so did the Master of Jordan. This man's demon was a crow, very like the Master's raven.
That's John Farr, the Lord of the Western Egyptians,
Tony whispered. John Farr began to speak.
Egyptians, welcome to the roping. We've come to listen and come to decide. You all know why. There are many families here who have lost a child. Some have lost 2. Someone has taken them. To be sure, landlopers are losing children too. We have no quarrel with the landlopers over this. Now, there's been talk about a child and a reward. Here's the truth to stop all gossip. The child's name is Lyra Belacqua, and she's been sought by the landlord police. There's a reward of 1,000 sovereigns for giving her up to them. She's a landlord child, and she's in our care, and there she's going to stay. Anyone tempted by those 1,000 sovereigns had better find a place neither on land nor on water. We ain't giving her up.
Lyra felt a blush from the roots of her hair to the soles of her feet. Pantaliman became a brown moth to hide. Eyes all around were turning to them, and she could only look up at Marcosta for reassurance. But John Farr was speaking again.
Talk all we may, we won't change out. We must act if we want to change things. Here's another fact for you. The gobblers, these child thieves, are taking their prisoners to a town in the far north, way up in the Land of Dark. I don't know what they do with them now. Some folks say they kill them. Other folks say different. We don't know. What we do know is that they do it with the help of the Landloper police and the clergy. Every power on land is helping them. Remember that. They know what's going on, and they'll help it whenever they can. So what I'm proposing ain't easy, and I need your agreement. I'm proposing that we send a band of fighters up north to rescue them kids and bring them back alive. I'm proposing that we put our gold into this and all the craft and courage we can muster. Yes, Raymond Van Herrett?
A man in the audience had raised his hand, and John Farr sat down to let him speak.
Beg pardon, Lord Farr. There's Landloper kids as well as Egyptians been taken captive. Are you saying we should rescue them as well?
John Farr stood up to answer.
Raymond, are you saying we should fight our way through every kind of danger to a little group of frightened children, and they say to some of them that they can come home and to the rest that they have to stay? No, you're a better man than that. Well, do I have your approval, my friends?
The question caught them by surprise, for there was a moment's hesitation. But then a full-throated roar filled the hall, and hands were clapped in the air, fists shaken, voices raised in excited clamour. The rafters of the Zaal shook, and from their perches up in the dark a score of sleeping birds woke up in fear and flapped their wings, and little showers of dust drifted down. John Farr let the noise continue for a minute, and then raised his hand for silence again.
This'll take a while to organise. I want the heads of the families to raise a tax and muster a levy. We'll meet again here in 3 days' time. And between now and then, I'm going to talk with the child I mentioned before, and with Father Coram, and form a plan to put before you when we meet. Good night to you all.
His massive, plain, blunt presence was enough to calm them. As the audience began to move out of the great doors into the chilly evening, to go to their boats or to the crowded bars of the little settlement, Lyra said to Mark Oster,
"Who are the other men on the platform?"
"The heads of the six families, and the other man is Father Coram."
It was easy to see who she meant by the other man, because he was the oldest one there. He walked with a stick, and all the time he'd been sitting behind John Farr, he'd been trembling as if with an ague.
"Come on,"
said Tony.
"I best take you up to pay your respects to John Farr. You call him Lord Farr. I don't know what you'll be asked, but mind you tell the truth."
Pantalaimon was a sparrow now and sat curiously on Lyra's shoulder, his claws deep in the wolfskin coat, as she followed Tony through the crowd up to the platform. He lifted her up. Knowing that everyone still in the hall was staring at her and conscious of those 1,000 sovereigns she was suddenly worth, she blushed and hesitated. Pantalaimon darted to her breast and became a wildcat, sitting up in her arms and hissing softly as he looked around. Lyra felt a push and stepped forward to John Farr. He was stern and massive and expressionless, more like a pillar of rock than a man, but he stooped and held out his hand to shake. When she put hers in, it nearly vanished.
"Welcome, Lyra."
Close to, she felt his voice rumbling like the earth itself. She would have been nervous but for Pantalaimon, and the fact that John Farr's stony expression had warmed a little. He was treating her very gently.
"Thank you, Lord Farr."
"Now you come in the parley room and we'll have a talk. Have they been feeding you proper, the Costas?"
"Oh, yes. We had eels for supper."
"Oh, proper fen eels, I expect."
The parley room was a comfortable place with a big fire, sideboards laden with silver and porcelain, and a heavy table darkly polished by the years, at which 12 chairs were drawn up. The other men from the platform had gone elsewhere, but the old shaking man was still with them. John Farr helped him to a seat at the table.
"Now you sit here, on my right,"
John Farr said to Lyra, and took the chair at the head of the table himself. Lyra found herself opposite Father Coram. She was a little frightened by his skull-like face and his continual trembling. His demon was a beautiful autumn-coloured cat, massive in size, who stalked along the table with upraised tail and elegantly inspected Pantalaimon, touching noses briefly before settling on Father Coram's lap, half-closing her eyes and purring softly. A woman whom Lyra hadn't noticed came out of the shadows with a tray of glasses, set it down by John Farr, curtsied and left. John Farr poured little glasses of Geneva from a stone crock for himself and Father Coram, and wine for Lyra.
So, you ran away, Lyra?
Yes.
And who was the lady you ran away from?
She was called Mrs. Coulter, and I thought she was nice, but I found out she was one of the gobblers. I heard someone say what the gobblers were. They were called the General Oblation Board, and she was in charge of it. It was all her idea, and they was all working on some plan. I don't know what it was, only they was going to make me help her get kids for him. But they never knew.
They never knew what?
Well, first, they never knew that I knew some kids what had been took. My friend Roger, the kitchen boy from Jordan College, and Billy Costa, and a girl out the Curran Market in Oxford. And another thing, my uncle, right, Lord Asriel, I heard them talking about his journeys to the north, and I don't reckon he's got anything to do with the gobblers, because I spied on the master and the scholars of Jordan, right? I hid in the retiring room where no one's supposed to go except them, and I heard him tell them all about his expedition up north, and the dust he saw, and he brought back the head of Stanislaus Grumman, what the Tartars had made a hole in. And now the gobblers have got him locked up somewhere. The armored bears are guarding him, and I want to rescue him.
She looked fierce and stubborn as she sat there, small against the high carved back of the chair. The two old men couldn't help smiling, but whereas Father Coram's smile was a hesitant, rich, complicated expression that trembled across his face like sunlight chasing shadows on a windy March day, John Farr's smile was slow, warm, plain, and kindly.
You better tell us what you did hear your uncle say that evening. Don't leave anything out, mind. Tell us everything.
Lyra did, more slowly than she told the Costas, but more honestly, too. She was afraid of John Farr, and what she was most afraid of was his kindness. When she'd finished, Father Coram spoke for the first time. His voice was rich and musical, with as many tones in it as there were colours in his demon's fur.
This dust. Did they ever call it anything else, Lyra?
No, just dust. Mrs. Coulter told me what it was, elementary particles. But that's all she called it.
And they think that by doing something to children, they can find out more about it?
Yes, but I don't know what, except my uncle. There's something I forgot to tell you. When he was showing them lantern slides, there was another one he had. It was the Aurora.
The what?
The Aurora. Is that right, Lyra?
Yeah, that's it. And in the lights of the Aurora, there was like a city. All towers and churches and domes and that. It was a bit like Oxford, that's what I thought anyway. And Uncle Asriel, he was more interested in that, I think. But the master and the other scholars were more interested in dust, like Mrs. Coulter and Lord Boreal and them.
I see. That's very interesting.
No, Lyra, I'm going to tell you something. Father Coram here, he's a wise man, he's a seer. He's been a following all what's been going on with dust and the gobblers and Lord Asriel and everything else, and he's been a following you. Every time the Costas went to Oxford, or half a dozen other families come to that, they brought back a bit of news about you, child. Did you know that?
Lyra shook her head. She was beginning to be frightened. Pantalaimon was growling too deep for anyone to hear, but she could feel it in her fingertips down inside his fur.
Oh, yes, all your doings, they all get back to Father Coram, eh?
Lyra couldn't hold it in.
We didn't damage it, honest. It was only a bit of mud, and we never got very far.
What are you talking about, child?
Father Coram laughed. When he did that, his shaking stopped and his face became bright and young. But Lyra wasn't laughing. With trembling lips, she said,
And even if we had found the bung, we'd never have took it out. It was just a joke. We wouldn't have sunk it, never.
Then John Farr began to laugh, too. He slapped a broad hand on the table so hard the glasses rang, and his massive shoulders shook, and he had to wipe away the tears from his eyes. Lyra had never seen such a sight, never heard such a bellow. It was like a mountain laughing.
Oh, yes, we heard about that too, little girl. I don't suppose the Costas have set foot anywhere since then without being reminded of it. You better leave a guard on your boat, Tony, people say. Fierce little girls round here. Oh, that story went all over the fens, child. But we ain't going to punish you for it. No, no. Ease your mind.
He looked at Father Coram and the two old men laughed again, but more gently. And Lyra felt contented and safe. Finally, John Farr shook his head and became serious again.
I was saying, Lyra, as we knew about you from a child, from a baby, you ought to know what we know. I can't guess what they told you at Jordan College about where you came from, but they don't know the whole truth of it. Did they ever tell you who your parents were?
Now Lyra was completely dazed.
Yes, they said I was... They said Lord Asriel put me there because my mother and father died in an airship accident. That's what they told me.
Ah, did they? Well, no, child, I'm going to tell you a story, a true story. I know it's true because Egyptian woman told me, and they all tell the truth to John Farr and Father Coram. So this is the truth about yourself, Lyra. Your father never perished in no airship accident. Because your father is Lord Asriel.
Lyra could only sit in wonder.
Here's how it came about. When he was a young man, Lord Asriel went exploring all over the north and came back with a great fortune. And he was a high-spirited man, quick to anger, a passionate man. And your mother, she was passionate too. Not so well-born as him, but a clever woman, a scholar even. And those who saw her said she was very beautiful. She and your father, they fell in love as soon as they met. The trouble was, your mother was already married. She married a politician. He was a member of the King's Party, one of his closest advisers, a rising man. Now, when your mother found herself with child, she feared to tell her husband the child wasn't his. And when the baby was born, that's you, girl, it was clear from the look of you that you didn't favour her husband, but your true father. And she thought it best to hide you away and give out that you'd died. So you was took to Oxfordshire, where your father had estates, and put in the care of an Egyptian woman to nurse. But someone whispered to your mother's husband what had happened, and he came a-flying down and ransacked the cottage where the Egyptian woman had been, only she'd fled to the great house, and the husband followed after in a murderous passion. Lord Asriel was out a-hunting, but they got word to him, and he came riding back in time to find your mother's husband at the foot of the great staircase. Another moment, and he'd have forced open the closet where the Egyptian woman was hiding with you. But Lord Asriel challenged him, and they fought there and then. And Lord Asriel killed him. The Egyptian woman heard and saw it all, Lyra. And that's how we know. The consequence was a great lawsuit. Your father ain't the kind of man to deny or conceal the truth, and it left the judges with a problem. He'd killed, all right. He'd shed blood. But he was defending his home and his child against an intruder. On the other hand, the law allows any man to avenge the violation of his wife, and the dead man's lawyers argued that he were doing just that. The case lasted for weeks, with volumes of argument back and forth. In the end, the judges punished Lord Asriel by confiscating all his property and all his land, and left him a poor man. He'd been richer than the king. As for your mother, she wanted nothing to do with it, nor with you. She turned her back. The Egyptian nurse told me she'd often been afeard of how your mother would treat you, because she was a proud and scornful woman. So much for her. Then there was you. If things had fallen out different, Lyra, you might have been brought up Egyptian, because the nurse begged the court to let her have you. But we Egyptians got little standing in the law. The court decided you was to be placed in a priory, and so you were, with the Sisters of Obedience at Watlington. You won't remember. But Lord Asriel wouldn't stand for that. He had a hatred of priors and monks and nuns, and being a high-handed man, he just rode in one day and carried you off. Not to look after himself, nor to give to the Egyptians. He took you to Jordan College, and dared the law to undo it. Well, the law let things be. Lord Asriel went back to his explorations, and you grew up at Jordan College. The one thing he said, your father, the one condition he made, was that your mother shouldn't be let to see you. If she ever tried to do that, she was to be prevented, and he was to be told, because all the anger in his nature had turned against her now. The master promised faithfully to do that, and so time passed. Then come all this anxiety about dust. And all over the country, all over the world, wise men, and women too, began worrying about it. It weren't of any account to us Egyptians until they started taking our kids. That's when we got interested, and we got connections in all sorts of places you wouldn't imagine, including Jordan College. You wouldn't know, but there's been someone watching over you and reporting to us ever since you've been there. "'Cause we got an interest in you. "'And that Egyptian woman who nursed you, "'she never stopped being anxious on your behalf.'
"'Who was it watching over me?'
said Lyra. "'She felt immensely important and strange "'that all her doings should be an object of concern so far away.
"'It was a kitchen servant. "'It was Bernie Johansson, the pastry cook. "'He's half-Egyptian. "'You never knew that, I'll be bound.'
"'Bernie was a kindly, solitary man.' One of those rare people whose demon was the same sex as himself. It was Bernie she'd shouted at in her despair when Roger was taken. And Bernie had been telling the Egyptians everything. She marvelled.
So anyway, we heard about you going away from Jordan College, and how it came about at a time when Lord Asriel was imprisoned and couldn't prevent it. And we remembered what he'd said to the master that he must never do. And we remembered that the man your mother had married, the politician Lord Asriel killed, was called Edward Coulter.
Mrs. Coulter? She ain't my mother.
She is. And if your father had been free, she wouldn't never have dared to defy him, and you'd still be at Jordan, not knowing a thing. What the master was a-doing letting you go was a mystery. I can't explain. He was charged with your care. All I can guess is that she had some power over him.
Lyra suddenly understood the master's curious behaviour on the morning she'd left.
But he didn't want to,
she said, trying to remember it exactly.
I had to go and see him first thing that morning, and I mustn't tell Mrs. Coulter. It was like he wanted to protect me from her.
She stopped and looked at the two men carefully, and then decided to tell them the whole truth about the retiring room.
See, there was something else. That evening I hid in the retiring room. I saw the master try to poison Lord Asriel. I saw him put some powder in the wine, and I told my uncle, and he knocked the decanter off the table and spilled it. So I saved his life. I could never understand why the master would want to poison him, because he was always so kind. Then on the morning I left, he called me in early to his study, and I had to go secretly so no one would know. And he said...
Lyra racked her brains to try and remember exactly what it was the master had said. No good. She shook her head.
The only thing I could understand was that he gave me something and I had to keep it secret from her. From Mrs. Coulter. I suppose it's all right if I tell you.
She felt in the pocket of the wolfskin coat and took out the velvet package. She laid it on the table and she sensed John Farr's massive, simple curiosity and Father Coram's bright, flickering intelligence both trained on it like searchlights. When she laid the alethiometer bare, it was Father Coram who spoke first.
Oh, I never thought I'd ever set eyes on one of them again. That's a symbol reader. Did he tell you anything about it, child?
No, only that I'd have to work out how to read it by myself. And he called it an alethiometer.
What's that mean?
Said John Farr, turning to his companion.
That's a Greek word. I reckon it's from aletheia, which means truth. It's a truth measure. And have you worked out how to use it?
No. At least, I can make the three shorthands point to different pictures, but I can't do anything with the long one. It goes all over. Except sometimes, right? Sometimes when I'm sort of concentrating, I can make the long needle go this way or that just by thinking it.
What should do, Father Coram? And how do you read it?
Are these pictures round the rim?
Said Father Coram, holding it delicately toward John Farr's blunt, strong gaze.
They're symbols, and each one stands for a whole series of things. Take the anchor there. The first meaning of that is hope. Because hope holds you fast like an anchor, so you don't give way. The second meaning is steadfastness. The third meaning is smag or prevention. The fourth meaning is the sea, and so on, down to 10, 12, maybe a never-ending series of meanings.
And do you know them all?
Well, I know some, but to read it fully I'd need the book. I seen the book, and I know where it is, but I ain't got it.
We'll come back to that. Go on with how you read it.
You got 3 hands you can control, and you can use them to ask a question. By pointing to 3 symbols, you can ask any question you can imagine, because you've got so many levels of each one. Once you've got your question framed, the other needle swings round and points to more symbols that give you the answer.
But how does it know what level you're thinking of when you set the question?
Ah, by itself it don't. It only works if the questioner holds the levels in their mind. You got to know all the meanings first, and there must be 1,000 or more. Then you got to be able to hold them in your mind without fretting at it or pushing for an answer. And just watch while the needle wanders. When it's gone round its full range, you'll know what the answer is. Well, I know how it works because I seen it done once by a wise man in Uppsala. And that's the only time I ever saw one before. Do you know how rare these are?
The master told me there was only 6 made.
Whatever the number, it ain't large.
And you kept this secret from Mrs. Coulter, like the master told you?
Yes, but her demon, right? He used to go in my room, and I'm sure he found it.
I see. Well, Lyra, I don't know if you'll ever understand the full truth, but this is my guess, as good as I can make it. The master was given a charge by Lord Asriel to look after you and keep you safe from your mother. And that's what he did for 10 years or more. Then Mrs. Coulter's friends in the church helped her set up this oblation board. For what purpose, we don't know. And there she was, as powerful in her way as Lord Asriel was in his. Your parents, both strong in the world, both ambitious, and the Master of Jordan holding you in the balance between them. Now, the Master's got 100 things to look after. His first concern is his college and the scholarship there. So, if he sees a threat to that, he has to move again it. And the church in recent times, Lara, it's been getting more commanding. There's councils for this and councils for that. There's talk of reviving the office of Inquisition, God forbid. And the master has to tread warily between all these powers. He has to keep Jordan College on the right side of the church, or he won't survive. And another concern of the master is you, child. Bernie Johansson was always clear about that. The Master of Jordan and the other scholars, they loved you like their own child. They'd do anything to keep you safe, not just because they'd promised to Lord Asriel that they would, but for your own sake. So, if the Master gave you up to Mrs. Coulter when he'd promised Lord Asriel he wouldn't, he must have thought you'd be safer with her than in Jordan College, in spite of all appearances. And when he set out to poison Lord Asriel, he must have thought that what Lord Asriel was doing would place all of them in danger, and maybe all of us too. Maybe all the world. I see the Master as a man having terrible choices to make. Whatever he chooses will do harm, but maybe if he does the right thing, a little less harm will come about than if he chooses wrong. God preserve me from having to make that sort of choice. And when it come to the point where he had to let you go, he gave you the symbol reader and bade you keep it safe. I wonder what he had in mind for you to do with it. As you couldn't read it, I'm foxed as to what he was thinking.
He said Uncle Asriel presented the alethiometer to Jordan College years before,
Lyra said, struggling to remember.
He was going to say something else, and then someone knocked at the door and he had to stop. What I thought was, he might have wanted me to keep it away from Lord Asriel too.
Or even the opposite.
What do you mean, John?
He might have had it in mind to ask Lyra to return it to Lord Asriel as a kind of recompense for trying to poison him. He might have thought the danger from Lord Asriel had passed, or that Lord Asriel could read some wisdom from this instrument and hold back from his purpose. If Lord Asriel's held captive now, it might help set him free. Well, Lyra, You better take this symbol reader and keep it safe. You've kept it safe so far, I ain't worried about leaving it with you. But there might come a time when we need to consult it, and I reckon we'll ask for it then.
He folded the velvet over it and slid it back across the table. Lyra wanted to ask all kinds of questions, but suddenly she felt shy of this massive man with his little eyes so sharp and kindly among their folds and wrinkles. One thing she had to ask, though.
Who was the Egyptian woman who nursed me?
Why, it was Billy Costa's mother, of course. She won't have told you, because I ain't let her, but she knows what we're a-talking of here, so it's all out in the open. Now, you'd best be getting back to her. You've got plenty to be a-thinking of, child. When 3 days is gone past, we'll have another roping and discuss all there is to do. You'll be a good girl. Good night, Lyra.
Good night, love, Far. Good night, Father Coram,
she said politely, clutching the alethiometer to her breast with one hand and scooping up Pantalaimon with the other. Both old men smiled kindly at her. Outside the door of the parley room, Ma Costa was waiting, and as if nothing had happened since Lyra was born, the boat mother gathered her into her great arms and kissed her before bearing her off to bed. Chapter 8. Frustration. Lyra had to adjust to her new sense of her own story, and that couldn't be done in a day. To see Lord Asriel as her father was one thing, but to accept Mrs. Coulter as her mother was nowhere near so easy. A couple of months ago she would have rejoiced, of course, and she knew that too, and felt confused. But being Lyra, she didn't fret about it for long, for there was the Fen town to explore and many Egyptian children to amaze. Before the 3 days were up, she was an expert with a punt, in her eyes at least, and she'd gathered a gang of urchins about her with tales of her mighty father, so unjustly made captive.
And then, one evening, the Turkish ambassador was a guest at Jordan for dinner, and he was under orders from the Sultan himself to kill my father, right? And he had a ring on his finger with a hollow stone full of poison. And when the wine come round, he made as if to reach across my father's glass, and he sprinkled the poison in. It was done so quick that no one else saw him, but...
What sort of poison?
Demanded a thin-faced girl.
Poison out of a special Turkish serpent,
Lyra invented.
What they catch by playing a pipe to lure out, and then they throw it a sponge soaked in honey, and the serpent bites it and can't get his fangs free, and they catch it and milk the venom out of it. Anyway, my father seen what the Turk done, and he says, "Gentlemen, I want to propose a toast of friendship between Jordan College and the College of Izmir, which was the college the Turkish ambassador belonged to. And to show our willingness to be friends," he says, "we'll swap glasses and drink each other's wine." And the ambassador was in a fix then, because he couldn't refuse to drink without giving deadly insult, and he couldn't drink it because he knew it was poisoned. He went pale, and he fainted right away at the table. And when he come round, they was all sitting there, waiting and looking at him. And then he had to either drink the poison or own up.
So, what did he do?
He drunk it. It took him 5 whole minutes to die, and he was in torment all the time.
Did you see it happen?
No, because girls ain't allowed at the high table. But I seen his body afterwards when they laid him out. His skin was all withered like an old apple, and his eyes were starting from his head. In fact, they had to push him back in the sockets.
And so on. Meanwhile, around the edges of the Fen country, the police were knocking at doors, searching attics and outhouses, inspecting papers and interrogating everyone who claimed to have seen a blonde little girl. And in Oxford, the search was even fiercer. Jordan College was scoured from the dustiest box room to the darkest cellar, and so were Gabriel and St. Michael's, till the heads of all the colleges issued a joint protest asserting their ancient rights. The only notion Lyra had of the search for her was the incessant drone of the gas engines of airships crisscrossing the skies. They weren't visible because the clouds were low, and by statute airships had to keep a certain height above Fen Country, but who knew what cunning spy devices they might carry? Best to keep undercover when she heard them, or wear the oilskin sou'wester over her bright, distinctive hair. And she questioned Ma Costa about every detail of the story of her birth. She wove the details into a mental tapestry even clearer and sharper than the stories she made up, and lived over and over again the flight from the cottage, the concealment in the closet, the harsh-voiced challenge, the clash of swords.
Swords? Great
God, girl, you dreaming? Mr. Coulter had a gun, and Lord Asriel knocked it out of his hand and struck him down with one blow. Then there was two shots. I wonder you don't remember, you ought to, little as you were. The first shot was Edward Coulter, who reached his gun and fired. And the second was Lord Asriel, who tore it out his grasp a second time and turned it on him, shot him right between the eyes and dashed his brains out. Then he says, cool as paint, come out, Mrs. Coster, and bring the baby, because you were setting up such a howl, you and that demon both. And he took you up and dandled you and sat you on his shoulders, walking up and down in high good humour with the dead man at his feet, and called for wine, and bade me swab the floor.
By the end of the fourth repetition of the story, Lyra was perfectly convinced she did remember it, and even volunteered details of the colour of Mr. Coulter's coat and the cloaks and furs hanging in the closet. Ma Costa laughed. And whenever she was alone, Lyra took out the alethiometer and pored over it like a lover with a picture of the beloved. So each image had several meanings, did it? Why shouldn't she work them out? Wasn't she Lord Asriel's daughter? Remembering what Father Coram had said, she tried to focus her mind on three symbols taken at random, and clicked the hands round to point at them, and found that if she held the alethiometer just so in her palms and gazed at it in a particular lazy way as she thought of it, the long needle would begin to move more purposefully. Instead of its wayward divagations around the dial, it swung smoothly from one picture to another. Sometimes it would pause at three, sometimes two, sometimes five or more, and although she understood nothing of it, she gained a deep, calm enjoyment from it, unlike anything she'd known. Pantalaimon would crouch over the dial, sometimes as a cat, sometimes as a mouse, swinging his head round after the needle. And once or twice the two of them shared a glimpse of meaning that felt as if a shaft of sunlight had struck through clouds to light up a majestic line of great hills in the distance, something far beyond and never suspected. And Lyra thrilled at those times with the same deep thrill she'd felt all her life on hearing the word North. So the 3 days passed, with much coming and going between the multitude of boats and the Zaal. And then came the evening of the second roping. The hall was more crowded than before, if that was possible. Lyra and the Costas got there in time to sit at the front, and as soon as the flickering lights showed that the place was crammed, John Farr and Father Coram came out on the platform and sat behind the table. John Farr didn't have to make a sign for silence. He just put his great hands flat on the table and looked at the people below, and the hubbub died.
Well, you've done what I asked, and better than I hoped. I'm going to call on the heads of the six families now to come up here and give over their gold and recount their promises. Nicholas Rokeby, you come first.
A stout, black-bearded man climbed onto the platform and laid a heavy leather bag on the table.
That's our gold, and we offer 38 men.
Thank you, Nicholas.
Father Coram was making a note. The first man stood at the back of the platform as John Farr called for the next, and the next, and each came up, laid a bag on the table, and announced the number of men he could muster. The Costas were part of the Stefanski family, and naturally Tony had been one of the first to volunteer. Lyra noticed his hawk demon shifting from foot to foot and spreading her wings, as the Stefanski money and the promise of 23 men were laid before John Farr. When the six family heads had all come up, Father Coram showed his piece of paper to John Farr, who stood up to address the audience again.
Friends, that's a muster of 170 men. I thank you proudly. As for the gold, I make no doubt from the weight of it that you've all dug deep in your coffers, and my warm thanks go out for that as well. What we are going to do next is this. We are going to charter a ship and sail north and find them kids and set them free. From what we know, there might be some fighting to do. It won't be the first time, nor it won't be the last, but we never had to fight yet with people who kidnap children, and we shall have to be uncommon cunning. But we ain't going to come back without our kids. Yes, Dirk Vries?
A man stood up and said,
Lord Farr, do you know why they captured them kids?
We heard it's a theological matter. They're making an experiment, but what nature it is, we don't know. To tell you all the truth, we don't even know whether any harm is to come at them. But whatever it is, good or bad, they got no right to reach out by night and pluck little children out the hearts of their families. Yes, Raymond Van Heret.
The man who'd spoken at the first meeting stood up and said,
That child, Lord Farr, the one you spoke of as being sought, the one as is sitting in the front row now. I heard as all the folk living around the edge of the fens is having their houses turned upside down on her account. I heard there's a move in Parliament this very day to rescind our ancient privileges on account of this child. Yes, friends,
he said over the babble of shocked whispers.
They're going to pass a law doing away with our right to free movement in and out the fens. Now, Lord Farr, what we want to know is this. Who is this child on account of which we might come to such a pass? She ain't an Egyptian child, not as I heard. How comes it that a landloper child can put us all in danger?